Hello, hello. You're listening to the Goggler Podcast. As always, Ian Bahir and Uma with you. We have just finished week one of Quarantine 2, the sequel.
Semicolon, the Biden weeks.
Exactly.
Has it only been 1 week of MCO 2?
It's only been 1 week, my friend.
Oh, it's sweet lordy. I could have sworn you were in our second week. Of course, weeks don't matter anymore.
Yeah, they don't. And the numbers over here in Malaysia are looking a little scary. So I don't think 2 weeks will be all that it is. It might be a lot longer.
It's going to be zero by next Tuesday. It's easy. It's Tuesday, easy, 26th. Right? It's going to be zero.
Yeah, what else has been happening this week? Oh, wait, there's a new president in America. And we've had an interesting, I guess, week of events. The last time we spoke to you, it felt like America in 2021 was worse than any kind of fiction we've actually seen on screen. All of your darkest nightmares coming through. And then today, the day after the inauguration is when we're recording this, there feels like everyone on Twitter seems to be filled with a new sense of hope and optimism, except maybe Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
There was a friend of mine posted three pictures on Facebook, which sort of really rounds all this up, right? Wednesday 2 weeks ago was the attack on Capitol Hill. Wednesday last week was the impeachment of Donald Trump. Wednesday this week is the inauguration. So it's a crazy 3 weeks encapsulated in three images, but at the same time, it sort of sets us up for the last maybe two and a half, 3 years, right?
Yeah.
It's a really interesting thing.
It's just, you just keep expanding the 30 Rock joke, you know? It's been a hell of a decade. It's only been 4 years, Lemon.
Yeah. Also, something to note as of the inauguration, Joe Biden is the first actor from Parks and Rec to become president of the United States, yes, of America.
I saw that tweet.
So far. Actually, one of the movies we're going to be talking about today, One Night in Miami, which is Regina King's directorial debut, feels like a very fitting watch for America right now. We're also going to be talking about WandaVision. The first two episodes dropped last Friday, and we have a lot to say about that. But first, did you guys catch the inauguration, the celebrations, yes, afterwards?
I skimmed it.
There was a fun moment at the concert towards the end of the day when they had all three previous presidents get together, and I felt that was a real wasted opportunity because they were all standing in a circle, and clearly no one has seen Spies Like Us in a while, and nobody went, "Mr. President, Mr. President, Mr. President, Mr. President, Mr. President." That's all I was waiting for. All right. Let's get into it. One Night in Miami is a brand new film on Amazon Prime Video. It is, of course, the directorial debut of Regina King, and is one of these, I guess, subjunctive histories, if you will, in the sense that it's based on an event that did happen, but of course, nobody knows what really happened in the conversation between these individuals. So
you mean like Leslie Odom Jr. would say, no one else was in the room when it happened?
Hey.
Correct. Hey. Correct.
But booms.
So on February 25th, 1964, in Miami, four of the greatest African-Americans of all time got together in a motel room to discuss the responsibility of being successful and black in America during the civil rights movement. And it's based on a play by Kemp Powers, who also wrote Soul, which we saw in December.
And he's a writer on Star Trek Discovery?
He's a writer, yes, on Star Trek as well, yeah.
Yeah.
And it stars Leslie Odom Jr. as Sam Cooke, Kingsley Benadire as Malcolm X, Eli Gorey as Cassius Clay / Muhammad Ali, and Aldous Hodge as Jim Brown. And it is, I felt, a really fantastic movie. I mean, it reminded me a little bit of Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, which just launched on Netflix, just Chadwick Boseman's last movie. Also because it was based on a real-life individual, and it was this kind of imagined conversations between these people. And in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, it was a successful female singer, jazz / blues singer at the time, who was incredibly powerful and used her power in interesting ways. And I think it is a narrative that kind of spins through this film as well. What did you guys think?
For me, it was an interesting watch because it feels, and not in a bad way, this feels like a film that that a new director could manage, right? There was, it's minimal locations, there are no big setups. A lot of the conversations, I love the way, and this sort of feels like a play in that the four main characters, there are four main characters in this, but they would partner up into little duos and have these little conversations in different places away from the others. And I just thought that that was a really good, manageable way to sort of set up the show and have the dialogue flow through really well. The performances throughout were amazing. I think Kingsley Benadire's Malcolm X was, I wouldn't say flawless, but was really spot on. My only issue is that at times it feels like he's trying to do the Malcolm X voice, and at times he falls into Barack Obama voice a little bit, I think.
He was Obama in the Comey role.
Oh! Which I haven't seen. Oh, okay, cool. Yeah, all right. So it feels, I mean, it feels a bit like he's trying to play up a thing. I thought Eli Gorey played Cassius Clay a lot better because like Malcolm X, Cassius Clay slash Muhammad Ali has got a very recognizable speaking pattern.
Yeah.
Didn't you think though, but they actually brought that in with Malcolm X that, like, you know, there's a point where they have a fight and they're, yes, like, you drop the mannerism.
Out of it. Yes. Yes.
Slips,
yes,
out of it. It's like, you blew my wig off. It's like,
And I mean, Aldous Hodge is amazing. Leslie Odom Jr. as Sam Cooke is just also spot on.
There's an old joke, right? Like an old stand-up thing that Trevor Noah used to do about how Obama developed his voice. And,
oh, I don't know that one, yeah.
He's like, he goes through the thing of, like, you know, speaking fast and then kind of slowing it down, sounding a little more like Nelson Mandela, and then like adding gravitas to it. It's a really funny bit. And I think those were the kind of little moments I thought that were really well written and really played, because it kind of highlighted how you have to change who you want to be or change who you are if you're fighting a specific cause to appeal to those people.
But also in this particular situation, they also call each other out on it, right? Like when Jim Brown lets slip in inverted commas that he wants to be an actor, they sort of, nobody else would speak to the great Jim Brown this way, right? Nobody else would call out Cassius Clay the way he does. And nobody would call out Sam Cooke the way Malcolm X does constantly in this film. But you kind of assume that the relationship these four had, that they would sort of hold each other accountable in that sense.
That's, yeah, I think that's something that I thought, that's the real meat of it. I think I should just go back and cut and paste some of my comments from last week, or our discussion last week when we were talking about waiting for the point to happen. Like, I know this has a basis in a play, and the stuff in the room seemed to be the meat and potatoes. Mm. But as a result, I think I watched the trailer and forgot mostly about the trailer. So I was a bit like Sam Cooke for a good part of the movie, where I was like, where's the party?
Right.
I think the trailer was incredibly misleading for this. It wasn't forefront of my mind, but I was like, I thought there were scenes of like a big party and stuff like that. And there is, like, I think it's about just about 10 minutes before the end stuff happens. And as a result, I wonder how much of the early stuff was added that was like, seemed to be setting me up for a different type of movie. You've got, is it Michael Imperioli is in it? And
as the coach, yeah.
As the coach and stuff. So there's these extra scenes that probably weren't in the play, right? You wouldn't have Cassius Clay fighting in the play. You concentrate on the people in the room talking.
Yeah, the play was a one-room play.
Exactly. So I felt that when that stuff happened, it threw everything else out the window where Lance Reddick was waiting. I was like, okay, none of this actually mattered. Like, I get you see some of their success and stuff like that, but why did we need to see Cassius Clay in Wembley? I mean, if that's because he has to lose so that he then seeks out Malcolm X in order to get his confidence back in order to win the next fight, that'd be great. That's not in the movie. That's not in the movie. So I was left wanting in that there was no explanation of how these guys knew each other apart from, like did they meet each other on, like, I can imagine Sam Cooke and Jim Brown meeting at parties, but I can't imagine Malcolm X being at the same party. And you get ideas they reference back to their past, but it's not like they all grew up on the street together. But I felt like there was a little gap there. When they actually got down to the real discussions, though, I really, really enjoyed it. But I felt that by that time then, we'd already spent an hour, and I was like, they could have just been like, we're going to hang out. You know what I mean? Like, there was this tension that didn't need to be there that could have then... what was the writer's name again? Kemp, is it?
Yes, Kemp Powers.
Kemp Powers. There was a tension that I didn't need there. Like, I didn't need Sam Cooke, you know, fidgeting and wandering around. It keeps the play moving. They only having ice cream and having no booze is kind of funny. But when they got down to the meat and potatoes, like Jim Brown talking to Malcolm X, and they're all right. Like, why shouldn't Sam Cooke take the white man's money and use it to build an empire that will help black people? And why is that? Yeah. And why is that wrong compared to what Malcolm X is doing?
Yes,
right. When it got to those things, it was great. But all the footing and footering and side eyes at Lance Reddick and stuff like that, and hints of the corruption around Elijah Muhammad, none of that had anything to do with the story, really. You know what I mean? Or if it could have been built up. Like, Malcolm X never tells his friends about his problem with Elijah Muhammad. It's hinted at during his conversations with his wife.
Yeah, he always sort of brushes it off, right? That, you know, I think at one point he says there are things happening between me and... He hasn't even...
Yeah.
He didn't want to tell the guys that he was leaving the Nation of Islam, right?
Right. And I wonder, is that because they didn't want to make Cassius Clay look like an asshole?
Mm.
Like, in history as opposed to in the story, you know what I mean?
Well, there is a... I think it was just a case of presumed knowledge, right? I think they just assume that you go into these kind of movies or plays knowing who these people are, which is probably a mistake on the part of the filmmaker to not actually include even the slightest hint. But you're right, Ian. I think watching it, it took me like a minute to get my bearings because I was like, wait, all these four were buddies? They all hung out together all the time? And then once I got into that groove, and then I was all in.
But then I wanted more of that groove. By that point then, my groove, the record had hit the center, the needle had hit the outside of the record, and
I was done. And you were on the couch and a little lazy and like, I don't want to walk over there and flip the record.
No, the other side was all scratched. The other side was blank. There was nothing on the other side but a label. I was totally getting into it then. You know what I mean?
But I think it's funny because I think in that sense, the movie was underwritten in that same way throughout. Like, for example, even at the end, not a spoiler because it's history, when they have a little press conference and he goes, you know, my name is Cassius X. The scene following that, it doesn't explain it, but, you know, Muhammad Ali left Malcolm X. He abandoned Malcolm X and he joined Elijah Muhammad and became Muhammad Ali, and he dropped the Cassius X moniker. And even in his biography, Muhammad Ali said that, you know, that was one of his biggest regrets because he thinks he let down his friend and he should have been there for him, right?
And I think there was also that sequence where...
But Muhammad none of that's Ali, explained in the film.
No.
You're right. And also even... And in fact, in the film, it sort of reads it differently because in the big hall where Cassius Clay announces himself to the Nation of Islam, there's a thing where the camera pans to an empty chair, you know, and Cassius...
Was it an empty chair? I was focused on the slightly white-looking guy. I didn't know there was a very white-skinned guy
I
there.
Was like, hey, look, it's a white guy in the Nation of Islam.
I didn't know what I was supposed to be looking at there. And also, I think, because the one night in Miami ends, and then it's the next scene is Sam Cooke singing, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Like, the night just comes to an ending. Is it right after? I think it's just right after the press
conference. It's right after. Yeah. And it feels very abrupt and very like...
Very abrupt. Very German.
Because I was thinking to myself, wait, how did we get here? You know, suddenly Sam Cooke singing in that show. I can't remember what the show was.
So that's a really interesting thing about the film as well. That was a recreation. So that actually happened in real life, but that footage has actually been lost. So Sam Cooke only sang that song once.
Did we read the same Screen Rant or Vulture article?
Is it a Screen Rant?
I haven't seen any.
There's a Vulture. I just Googled it and there was like under news, it's like truth versus fiction and you're literally going through them in order right now.
Oh, really? Okay. Cool.
All right. Not bad for three Malaysians.
Yeah, because no, I mean, well, Uma's well read. I'm just lazy.
I'm just like really lucky to be hitting all these points.
No. In Muhammad Ali's biography, there's a lot of stuff where they talk about the Miami stuff and joining Malcolm X and all of that stuff. There's a new biography that came out about a year and a half ago, and it's really good. It talks about a lot of this stuff. And I don't know what it must have looked or sounded like, but the Leslie Odom Jr. recreation was pretty fantastic. Like, I thought that moment when he's singing A Change Is Gonna Come is incredibly moving. And I was also, I thought that was a really clever decision on the part of the director to sit, because if you think Sam Cooke, you think of that damn song, right? And you're waiting, and you're like, is this movie going to play that damn song?
Yeah.
And then it happens, and that felt like a great little payoff to everything they'd been talking about.
But it's also a good payoff because it comes after what's happened in the room, right? When Malcolm X puts on the Bob Dylan track. And
yeah.
And because Malcolm X holds that over Sam Cooke, that, and again, allegedly because nobody else was in the room when it happened. Hey, that Sam Cooke would sing these love songs, these R&B songs that were okay for white
money makers, right?
Yeah. And that was what Malcolm X was saying when he played Bob Dylan's
Blown in the Wind.
Yes, and it's just like, you know, you should have written the song. Why is a white man writing a song about struggle? And
yeah,
their struggle.
Yeah, for their struggle. Yes. So for Sam Cooke to then eventually come up with A Change Is Gonna Come and be able to do that on his own was, it feels like a payoff to that to that fight.
Again, that's just quoting Vulture again. They kind of pointed out that, like, you know, working on the Chain Gang was his song as well. So he had that. So that's fine. You can take the artistic license with that kind of stuff, and it makes a better story.
Oh, because they're saying that because he wrote Working on a Chain Gang before.
Yeah, like he had a history of it. He just happened across the greatest.
Right. The core of the movie, like you said, Ian, was the conversations that these guys were having in the room, and that's where the messaging really is. And I think that the four performers, I think, pulled all of that off really well because it was kind of undercut with the banter, with humor, while they didn't shy away from those very difficult conversations about, I guess, one, insecurity of being black in America, but also, even more than that, the insecurity that comes with being successful and black in America.
Yeah. And just being truculent.
Yeah, what a great word.
I was like, oh, someone's showing off, but like, he is damn truculent, you know. It's the banter and the gags and everything, and you can easily lean into impressionism when it comes to Muhammad Ali, but Eli Gori stayed nicely away from that. Like, I did, like I said, I liked all that so much that I was kind of like, I love Lance Reddick, and when he just says like, you know, out the door, it's amazing. But that's like, it wasn't even here. Like, at the end, Malcolm X sees someone through the window talking to what you presume are the feds outside, and it's a guy we've never seen before.
Yeah.
I'm like, I was like, okay, I presume that's a Nation of Islam guy, but like, would it not make more sense for him to be someone we've seen in a movie setting? There's just little things like that where it was just like, you didn't need Lance Reddick, and if you did, why didn't you use him be that guy? Because he's already kind of an ass, and he's obviously loyal to
Elijah Muhammad.
So, and he's keeping an eye on Malcolm. That would make perfect sense. So it just was like, you're raising questions you don't need 5 minutes before the end of the movie.
For a directorial debut, I think it was quite well handled by Regina King.
Oh, no.
But like you said, it's not a difficult movie to put together for a first time director.
Yes.
But I thought the way she framed the conversations, for me. Actually, the true skill came during the boxing sequences where I thought those were incredibly well shot, and you could see everything. There was no shaky cam.
Yeah.
Everything was pulled off really well, and it looked like a dance. It looked like how Muhammad Ali fights, which is incredibly difficult to shoot.
Yeah. And she went out there and she cast an actor to play Jimmy Carson and Ed McMahon and used them for 30 seconds. I mean, it's great.
Yeah.
Just a setup. It was a weird little thing. But I think I would have preferred it if it had actually had a smaller budget and had skipped those fights or had woven them in better. Did you notice as well, I think from the inauguration, Michelle Obama was apparently going as Regina King cosplay.
Right.
She looked like the purple version of Regina King's outfit. Like, was it Crime Nun? What was it? The Nun?
Oh, yeah.
In Watchmen?
Watchmen.
What was she called?
It was such a long time ago, Ian, I can't remember now.
It's been 84 years.
Yeah. My first impression when I saw her walk in was like, God damn, she's pulling some real, you know, Shaft vibes there with the pantsuit and that purple.
Also, yeah.
I went Carmen San Diego, but yeah, Watchmen's good as well.
She didn't have a big hat. Maybe she left her big hat at home.
Didn't get it through security.
Garth Brooks stole the hat.
Oh, one final thing for me on this is that fuck you, Beau Bridges.
That scene was fantastic. Like, I did not, I knew something was up, but when it hit, I was like, whoa, like you felt it.
Yeah. Also, was that Forrest's house?
I was going to ask, yeah, because it really looks like Forrest
Gump. It looked like Forrest Gump's house.
I think it's the same house they use in Forrest Gump, in The Patriot, in Antebellum. I think they just use the same house for everything.
It was a City of Bones, House of Shadows, one of those young adult books look like that as well. But that for those of you who haven't seen the movie yet, there's a scene where they have a big, long conversation between Jim Brown and Beau Bridges' character, and it's about how he's a hero. Jim Brown is a hero for the NFL, all that kind of stuff. And they're sitting on the porch drinking lemonade, and when they go in, when his granddaughter asks to go inside and move something, Jim Brown asks if he needed a hand, and just so fucking
matter of factly,
is just Beau Bridges just says, "You know, we don't allow N-words in the house," and it's just
But it's also the way he delivers, right? It's not even like an insult. It's like, "Oh, you silly boy! You know, we don't let your kind in here,"
which is the biggest. It's not like it's an insult. It's like a comet crashing into planet Earth level insult. That's the struggle. I mean, that was one extra bit. That needed to be there, so you had Jim Brown struggle later on. You know, between everything to show off his approach to things.
Because when that scene first happened, the way Aldous Hodge plays it is it almost looks like he's waiting for the other shoe to drop. Right, he's waiting for the request to come in. He's waiting for the hey, you boy, help me with this thing. And I thought that was what was going to happen, because they, you know, barely through the conversation, the granddaughter comes out and says, "Oh, don't forget, you have to move the little cabinet for me." You know, I thought it was going to be I thought this was all engineered to get Jim Brown over to move the furniture. But it's an even bigger fuck you by saying, no, we don't let your kind in the house.
Yeah, and that I thought you were going to say that look on his face afterwards, because it looks like he's going to tear the columns out of the door and just smash the house to the ground and salt the earth.
And you know he can.
Yes.
Yes. Jim Brown, of course, is the only one who's still alive. I think he's in his late 80s, if I'm not mistaken, or early 80s. Yeah.
And I think he still sort of commentates on some NFL games as well. He still shows up for the Super Bowl and things like that. He's still considered one of the best running backs of all time.
Right. Muhammad Ali, of course, passed away a few years ago, and the movie is set a year before the death of Sam Cooke and the murder of Malcolm X as well.
Yes.
So, yeah, to give you a sense of when this movie takes place in these men's lives.
I'd also say Jim Brown was in The Running Man as Fireball. He was Byron Williams in Mars Attacks. He was in The Dirty Dozen.
Oh, yeah, like, he's been in a lot of films.
When you see his face, you'll know who we're talking about.
Exactly, yeah.
Correct.
Aldous Hodge looks very little like him.
Yes, he does, yeah. I was going to quickly jump in for a bit and say that on Netflix, there's a great little documentary. I think it's maybe about 45 an hour long. Called The Two Deaths of Sam Cooke, or something like that. And it's a really good examination about, because Sam Cooke's death is mired in a little bit of controversy and how it happened. So if you're curious, if you want to follow it up, that's a really interesting piece to go into.
I mean, this movie will do that. In the sense that it will send you down a rabbit hole, if you're so inclined, to find out more about these individuals and what they got up to before and after the events of the film. So, One Night in Miami is now streaming on Amazon Prime Video. Do check it out. There has been some Oscar buzz, especially with regard to the performances in particular. So I guess we'll see how that plays out if there is an Oscars this year. Up next, we're going to be talking about WandaVision, which is the first Marvel Studios television production and the first Phase 4 installment in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. It was supposed to be Black Widow, obviously, but then because of all those delays, Phase 4 is kicking off on television with this story that takes place after Avengers Endgame. Kind of centers around the lives of Wanda Maximoff and Vision. And it is a very strange and surreal series that seems to take place in sitcoms throughout the ages.
Yeah, if you're confused why Vision seems to be in it and you're thinking, wasn't he the guy who died in Avengers?
Infinity War.
Infinity War? Well, yes, he was. And yes, that's the thing.
And nobody knows why he's here either. So
yeah. So are we going to go light spoilers then heavy spoilers? Or are we assuming people have watched it and we'll go for it?
Well, the first two episodes are out and I don't know
how to spoil it.
You can even call it spoilers because we have no idea what the fuck is going on.
Yeah, but that in itself, talking about that is a spoiler. Maybe we should talk about our impressions. First of all, we can use our own internal embargo, and then at the end we can go off the deep end into speculation and stuff.
Sure.
the Impressions was like, okay, we'd seen the fun bits, we'd seen all this kind of sitcom stuff and I Dream of Jeannie and Bewitched especially.
The Brady Bunch and stuff, yeah.
Yeah, and I watched it and I was totally into it because I was into it so much that I wonder who it's for, because they're like, big market is like, it's not us. It can't be us. I mean, we have enough money to buy, you know, people our age have the money to buy the hot toys, all that kind of crap. But like, that's not, it's weird to be making this movie, this TV show now. Like, you know, I don't know. Does Nick at Night still exist in the US? Are there still Bewitched reruns running somewhere in America? Because I remember watching Bewitched as it was repeated on like Sky One, which was then a fledgling channel in the UK. Yeah. And they just bought whatever cheap content they could get and just threw it on at all times of the day.
After watching the first two episodes, it occurred to me that that isn't important, right? I mean, at first I was concerned because I was thinking, oh wait, do I need to know The Dick Van Dyke Show? Do I need to know Bewitched? Do I need to know I Dream of Jeannie or I Love Lucy to get any of the jokes or the references as to what's going on? But the show is so well written and it is so funny by itself. Like, the both of them do these performances so well that you don't need to know that Wanda is channeling Mary Tyler Moore by wearing pants and hinting about cooking the perfect breakfast like all the 1950s housewives used to do. Because, you know, that's a by the by. If you get that, great, then you can laugh at the meta joke. But the jokes themselves are funny enough.
But what do you think if you're a 21-year-old who, you know, was born in the year 2000 and has never seen a black and white anything?
Yeah.
Are you going to... Because there are people who get turned off by that, you're right?
Yeah, but I think for those people, if you were 21, 22, and you've grown up watching Marvel movies from the time you were 6 or 7, then I think the Marvel appeal is enough, right?
Mm. You would sort of take it at face value, right? Yeah.
Yeah, so I think it works on many levels in that sense. So I was talking to some people on Instagram, and it feels like a lot of people were taking away many different things from the show. So Carly Knitt says, I watched The Dick Van Dyke Show in my teens due to my love for vintage sitcoms. So I don't think she was in her teens in the 1950s.
In the 60s.
Yeah. I watched WandaVision and realized the backdrop and the humor were an inspiration from all the DVDs I used to watch. Paul and Elizabeth really did an excellent, immense job of acting vintage and spot on with the humor, which made me laugh. So,
yeah,
you know, that works.
I think that's it. That's we should. I wasn't criticizing in any way. It's just that it was interesting to see them go so hard on this because they do go so hard and it does work. It's genuinely funny. Paul Bettany, I think, gets the better shake of the stick because he gets to do more kind of ludicrous slapstick,
right?
Kooky
whereas,
stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, he gets to go like full cookie, especially that second episode.
And then Trav Demand says, I'm loving where Marvel is heading, taking massive risks like WandaVision, and I believe it will land. From where they were the last time, the possibilities are endless. Meanwhile, at Warner DC, .. Which I wanted to mention just because I quite enjoy the DC TV shows a lot.
Right.
Especially things like Doom Patrol. I think Swamp Thing had a lot of potential, but they kind of canceled it even before it finished. But the DC CW shows really feel incredibly basic after watching something like WandaVision. I went to see the first episode of Batwoman because, you know, they changed the actress, Ruby Rose quit and all that. And I wanted to find out...
It's a new character, right?
Yeah, it's a whole new character. And I wanted to find out how they were going to handle that. And after watching WandaVision, it is just the most basic writing ever. It's like, there's a GPS on the suit. Quick, let's find her. And it's just like, it is disappointing and lazy compared to what is going on in this show, right?
I was surprised I saw the headline that, you know, I think it might have been, again, Vulture or something else. I was looking at something else. And it said that the new Lois and Clark show will have a 90-minute premiere and it'll have I think it's one episode with a kind of a follow-up thing about the legacy of the Lois and Clark in general. And they were talking about how it's not really necessary. But the biggest takeaway I took is that The Flash is still running. Because I used to watch that all the time. I forgot that show's still on.
Still on, my friend. And he's still kind of sad and depressed. And blaming himself for all his friends getting killed. Yeah.
And that's the thing, right? I suspect it's a DC thing, how these DC content, these DC TV shows are always pushed on to TV and given a TV budget, whereas WandaVision is being treated the way Netflix treats a TV show, right? It's not, they're given a million plus per episode. Sure, they're only doing 8, but The Flash, like you said, and Batwoman, they've been running for so long that you think maybe give it a little bit more money and not just treat it like another YA sort of teen.
Well, they did. They did Crisis on Infinite Earths and they did the other Crisis on Earth X, and they spent that money.
Yeah, I guess.
But Bahe, I don't know, man. I mean, you know, back in the day, the West Wing was being made on $1 million, $2 million. This one, I think with WandaVision, I think they're probably tripping over to 10, 15 million per episode. I mean, this feels like 9 half an hour installments for an MCU film. I mean, the production value is insane. Yeah. Like, I was looking at episodes 1 and 2 again when we were doing our explainers, and even the color palette of black and white shifts, like how the episodes would shift between the 1950s and the 1960s. Mm. That's the kind of detail that has gone into the making of this show.
That's just an Instagram filter. But also, it's that their TV approach is actually the switch of what it used to be, because Marvel were churning out their weekly comics and DC was doing the prestige graphic novels in the Vertigo and stuff like that. You know, you had like Arkham Asylum or The Dark Knight, and now it's completely flipped where the DC shows are your almost disposable issues, where if you miss a season or two, it doesn't matter. Although it does matter a bit, because every time I see a promo for The Flash now, I'm like, who are all these people? I don't know who any of these people are. I recognize Barry, and everyone else is like, it's not like one or two people. There's like an entire cast of people I've never seen before.
No, but you say that, but there is so little, and this is the most striking thing about it, there is so little progress within those shows. So, and I think it's just because they're still catering for that old network model, right? Because at the end of the season, you got to defeat the big bad. Something big might happen, but on the whole, unless an actor has decided to leave the series, everyone still comes back, right?
But it's not even that. It's also just over the course of that season, they're going, you know, they're falling in love, falling out of love, falling in love with someone else, realizing it's wrong, then going back. And that's on top of the big bad, on top of the, you know, the familial relationships they have. It's the
cue the Paula Cole music, right? Is it?
Yeah,
is it Paula Cole. Yeah, I don't want to wait.
Yeah,
you can put the Dawson's Creek theme over it, and it still works.
It'll still work, right? It's the A plot, B plot, C plot, D plot, E plot, F plot, and if they keep going, how far down they go the alphabets.
And this series feels genuinely interesting and new in that I don't know where it's going, and I'm curious to find out more, and there's a mystery that I want to figure out.
And also, there's a lot of trust, right? Because I was watching that first episode and I went, I was wondering how many people would go, why is the WandaVision sort of magic so cheesy looking, right?
Yeah.
It's obviously cups on a string. And you just go, Marvel has got the guts to say, screw you guys. If you know what we're about, you're going to trust us for this hour.
Those plates flying and that one glass being very badly dried by a towel, that costs millions in CGI effects to make them look that crap.
Maybe, yeah.
That leads to my amazement at the commitment to the bit, because I assumed there was going to be channel hopping and stuff like that from the trailers, and we know there's going to be 80s Full House pastiche coming at some point. I don't know, we've done the 50s and the 60s, what's this? I don't know what the 70s standout is going to be before we get to the kind of 80s style.
70s is Brady Bunch.
Oh, okay.
I mean, that was the big thing, right? And the Partridge Family, I guess.
Yeah, because they said that they were doing the Brady, because I think there was an interview that said they did shoot the Brady Bunch style opening.
Oh, nice.
Squares. Yeah. Nice. Although it's probably hexagons, considering there's a weird obsession with hexagons.
Mindstone. Yeah.
But it was the commitment to the bit that I was surprised at. I thought, like, there's no hints that anything weird is going on for like 80%, 90% of that first show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think
until Kitty from the 70s show starts going, stop it. Stop it. And her husband is like, why are you here? Isn't that what he keeps asking? Why are you here?
So there's that. You're right. It's that commitment to not let the audience in on this, right? And it's the kind of thing where, like, as soon as that first credit started to roll, how many people could have potentially turned it off because they think
there are three sets of credits, right?
They're crazy numbers of credits, you know. And
there's the in-show credits, then there's the show kind of cool,
like the MCU credits, right?
Yeah. What are those things called? Those little, like, they're not pixels, right? But there was like the three little things. If you got too close to your TV, like the credits are made up of those three little phosphorant squares that your TV would have if you got too close to it. There was like red, green, and blue. It was the Telefunken logo, and the whole beautiful thing about that. And then after that, there's more credits.
Yes, there was the subtitle credits, yeah, and the international credits. Yeah.
That's why I realized that the show wasn't actually 30 minutes, because there's 7 minutes of credits at the end of each episode.
Also, can I just say, speaking of credits, that means in each of these nine episode run, they'd have to have a new opening credit every time.
Yeah.
They have to have new music every time. Oof.
It's not something new that Marvel is doing, in the sense that they've all of their movies, they've always tried to pay homage or take inspiration from a bunch of other things, right? Which was always the way that they led you into something. So if you think about Guardians of the Galaxy, for example, the opening sequence is with that very clear homage to Raiders of the Lost Ark. It was a very cunning way to bring you into a story based around characters you knew nothing about. I mean, Guardians of the Galaxy were characters that even comic book nerds knew very little about, right? Because they were C-D-list.
Well, I mean, it wasn't the Indiana Jones. It was the dancing.
And the dancing as well. And so, with Captain America Winter Soldier kind of being very French Connection-y and Manchurian Candidate-like. And so they've always kind of paid homage to these different genres and different types of films, which is why their films don't necessarily fall under the straight-up superhero movie category, right? And even in Civil War, when they kind of shook things up by taking the third act climax and moving it into the middle of the film and then having a completely different ending, a style for an ending, because at the time, everyone was kind of complaining about, when you reach the third act, it's just bish, bosh, boom, CGI, right? And so I think we've seen them push the envelope like this. I mean, I remember that third episode in Daredevil when we had the corridor fight scene was nothing like we'd ever seen before, and we were just blown away. So I'm curious as to how this is actually going to fit in with the non-Marvel fans. I mean, that's what I want to know. So if you haven't seen the 23 movies, do you even bother with this? Or is this just something they've created going, hey, you've watched 3,000 hours of Marvel stuff. This one's just for you. Like, because it feels like that for me, right?
Yeah, that calls back to my original point. Like, if you don't know what the stuff is and you see the Vision in black and white with the weird head, you're like, nah, I'm out. You know what I mean? It's like, I can see that being off-putting to a lot of people.
Do you see that being the same way with Mando as well?
I don't know, because I think that Star Wars has penetrated the pop culture so much that I think, like, we didn't... And that first season did it, like, you talked about the MCU movies weren't superhero movies. That first season wasn't a Star Wars show. It was a Western. And I know some friends of mine actually liked the second season less because it was too deep into Star Wars lore a little bit. They didn't want that stuff. They just enjoyed the high noon of it all in the first season.
Whereas the kung fu. Season went, yeah.
Yeah. The littlest hobo.
Yeah. Yeah, but hey, what do you think? I mean, is it... All of the people I talk to, like all of my friends, have seen Marvel movies. I need to find someone who hasn't. Like, even my mom, who's watched WandaVision now, she's seen all the Marvel movies. So even she knows what's going on.
Yeah, is there anyone left who hasn't seen the Marvel movie?
Well, I'd like...
Donald Trump.
Probably. Yeah. I mean, I'd like to hear from people who don't... I mean, I know there are a lot of people who don't like science fiction and who don't like these sorts of superhero fare.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I want them to watch something like this because I think the cleverness of what they're trying to do kind of transcends the franchise-ness of it all.
But I think, it goes back to what I was saying earlier about how you have to trust the audience that they will be willing to stick through this thing that they're trying to do without any explanation, right? We don't know why we're here. If there, you know, maybe some people will go... Would need to know.
Does anyone know really we're here? Does anyone know why we're here?
Does anybody know why we're here? You're right. Yeah. Existential question time. But again, it's that trust, right? You have to have faith that the people who will respond to something like this, either because they're weird in their own way and like stuff like this, or that they trust Marvel enough to pull something like this off, will stick through it. And those who don't may just get swept up in the drama of it all later on, you know?
Yeah, the only feedback I got off Twitter was from at 15 Minutes of Marvel, which is a 15-minute Marvel podcast, who said it's so mysterious and dark and intriguing and amazing. That falls into what we're talking about. It's just like staying within the lines, as it were.
I mean, look, my dad's not a huge sci-fi guy. He doesn't enjoy sci-fi, but about a couple of months ago when we could still travel, I sort of popped in to say hi, and he was like, "Bye. What is The Mandalorian? This is amazing. I had never heard anything about it, but it's so good." And you just go, "Oh, cool." So he knew enough about Star Wars. He knew the brand, knows nothing. You know, he probably knows the name Boba Fett, but sure as hell hasn't gone down the rabbit hole.
Yeah. Mobile Fett. Yeah, Mobile Fett. That's what it sounds like.
Yeah, that guy, right? Yeah. So I think with The Mandalorian, you know enough about the brand Star Wars to sort of give it a shot. And I think to know enough about the Marvel brand to say, yeah, I'll give WandaVision a shot, to sit through a half an hour on that and not be intrigued by it, I think the show's not for you anyway.
Yeah. I mean, these are also, even for people who have watched Marvel movies, these two characters, like, the relationship was barely on screen, right? There was a bit in Civil War. It was like, it's Age of Ultron, Civil War, and
Infinity War.
Yeah, that's it.
That's pretty much it. I mean, and the reason I brought it up was because I was thinking, I started doing this thing just this year because I'm sure you guys are doing it as well. Because we can't remember what we've seen in January and December, I've just started making a list of things that I think are really fucking good, right?
Oh, I've joined Letterboxd.
Oh, really?
Oh, sorry, I logged back in again. Sorry, I joined it like 5 6 years ago. I'm just going to keep a running list there because it's easier than writing it down somewhere.
Right, and so in my notebook, like, you know, it's only like week 3 now of 2021, and I had Lupin down, the new Netflix crime series, as a really fantastic series of 2021, and of course I had WandaVision down. And I kept thinking, because the one thing people always do to us is, hey, recommend something, right? Mm. Because we watch so much crap. And I kept thinking, wow, WandaVision's really fucking good. Like, it's got everything I would want when I talk about things that are well-made, well-written, well-thought-out. And yet, I feel hard-pressed to recommend it to people because it feels like such a deep dive.
It was what I was going to say. It's something that you would want, right? Is it something that someone else who hasn't read 20, 30 years worth of comics would want to watch.
It is laser focused at marketing at us. Like, it is like a cruise missile aimed directly for our recording suites.
But you say that, but yet when you think about everything that makes for a great TV show and you make a top 10 list, this thing ticks everything off. Like, there's a lot of stuff that's laser targeted towards us that we lap up like the nerds that we are, but actually, you know, that aren't nearly as well made as this.
Yeah. But I mean, I could see those people being completely put off by the fake ad for the toaster where people stare at a red button for far too long. The second time around, I was looking at that going like, what? This is, that is weird. That segment. I mean, like, they're trying to get something, they're trying to get some idea across there, whether it's a bomb or something that's going to come up later. But it lingers for way too long and it's nicely weird, but it's like if someone's vibing, I can think of different people who are liking different parts, like someone who would vibe on the retroness of it all, that might kick them out. Someone who's vibing on Paul Bettany just being a hoot, they might be put off by some of the weirder elements or the rewind thing at the end or the B-man or something. So it's a gamble, but I think they've made quite a bit of money off those Avengers movies. So I think there might be a market for it.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think you might be right. It's might be touch and go, but you'd be right. Yeah, they might have broken even.
Did anyone who replied to us, Uma or Bahir, did anyone mention Lynchian? Because did you see there was like people complaining about this?
Yeah, I saw that on the internet, but
nobody said anything.
No one brought up the word Lynchian in our replies.
Well, that's good because it's not.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah, I think Lynchian's a bit of a stretch, to be fair.
I think people throw out the word Lynchian without actually having seen the insanity that is Twin Peaks.
Yeah. And the brilliance that is Twin Peaks.
And the brilliance, yeah, exactly. Or even Mulholland Drive. Man, that movie, I had to watch it so many times to figure out what the hell was going on. Also, yeah, like you, I think, Ian, I watched this twice, but also because the first time I was watching this stupid show, WandaVision, I kept going, what is it trying to tell me? Why is that toaster blinking? Yeah. What's going on?
Yes.
This show is too smart for me. I don't know what's happening.
Yeah. Yeah. It was about 15 minutes. I think it was about when the Harts arrived at the house and they were doing the whole thing about how when WandaVision was trying to do the cooking with the chicken and going too far back in time. And I sat there just going, okay, stop it, Bahe, stop it. Just watch the damn thing. Just watch the damn thing. Yeah, just take it. Don't think about what they're trying to say. Don't think about.
Yeah.
Don't try and find the hooks and the Easter eggs. Just sort of sit there and watch it.
And I think that's a good piece of advice to anyone trying to watch this, because if there is one thing that the Marvel Cinematic Universe is, it is incredibly commercial. It isn't David Lynch. They are going to explain everything at the end. They want you to get it, right? This is a mass market product. It may not feel like it, but I think by the time you get to episode 9, you'll understand what's going on.
As everything comes to a head and there's like all shit's kicking off and Sword is outside their reach, and then Phil Coulson steps into the frame.
Yes.
That is all I want. Long live Phil Coulson.
And also, it's this idea that there's going to be a myriad of YouTube videos, YouTube articles written about it after the episode. So don't freak out about you not finding anything during the show. There are people out there who do that. In fact, you will
just
do
like
it.
We did, by
you. Yeah. We will break it down for you. So don't get
there's a whole multitude of madness out there, multiverse of madness.
Yeah. Hey.
Don't get caught up in trying to catch the thing, you know, going back 3 seconds, going forward 2 frames. It's fine. Sit there, enjoy it for half an hour, and then give it a couple hours and then go online. You'll find a number of, you know, videos and articles about breaking down the Easter eggs you might have missed and the what does this mean for the next episode.
Yeah, I mean, my mate Dave got in touch and was just saying, like, what the actual frack about the Bova milk stuff?
Oh, Bova, yeah!
Yeah.
That is a deep cut.
Yeah, he was like, he was referring to your article. He was like, what the hell is this?
Yeah, it's the whole show is just a deep cut. So just enjoy it and then move on.
So if you want to go check out our site where you can see that article as well.
Yeah, we've got 2 articles that kind of list some theories and a whole bunch of Easter eggs as to what's going on in the first 2 episodes. But I was going to ask you guys, what kind of theories do you have? I mean, is this all just a figment of Wanda's imagination?
So we should, if you don't want spoilers or speculation, quit now, because what was it? There was something it wasn't Picard, was it Discovery season? It was Discovery season 1, right? Where we were like, maybe it's a mirror universe thing, and it totally was,
yes,
right?
Yeah.
Well, there were 2 things which we hit the nail on the head on Discovery season 1. It was the mirror universe thing, and then I went down an IMDb rabbit hole with regards to the Klingon guy and being played by an actor who was made up and didn't exist.
Yeah,
yeah. Yes, remember that. Yeah.
I think I did. There were some things I said as well, and something that was like, I was joking, and it turned out to be true.
And it turned out to be true,
But it's all down to Catherine Hahn. Catherine Hahn, it's all set up for her own show. That's what it is. Because she's great.
It's her entry into the MCU, right?
I was looking to see, like, you know, because she's obviously been, like, underserved in a lot of things. And there is a movie. She was talking about herself and Judy Greer always playing the best friend in some article.
Yeah.
Mm.
And I was just like, that's just WandaVision season 2. Just bring Judy Greer. Judy Greer's in the MCU from Ant-Man, right?
Yep, she is.
So they can just bring them over. The 2 of them have their own show.
Paul Rudd's ex-wife, right? It. Yeah.
Yeah, because she's so good. She's so... Mm. There's got to be a weird energy on set, right? When, like, I mean, I know you're acting. There's always a weird energy on set. But they're so over the top with that. Yeah. Like, Elizabeth Olsen, like, she's not doing... It's no mark against her acting or anything. It's just the fact that she's given the role of kind of react... She's the straight man.
Yes.
Yeah. She's very much being the straight man.
Well, she has to do 2 things, right? She's got to play the straight man character, but then she's also got to shift into the I realize something is going wrong mode.
Mm.
Yeah. Mm. Whereas Catherine Hahn just gets to be and just like plays everything as broad as the continental United States.
I also love the fact that in episode 2, Emma Caulfield's in it and there's a bunny. And everyone knows in Buffy she hates bunnies.
She's basically just playing like grown-up married Anya, right?
Yeah, essentially. Mm.
And it was a joy to see her again. I haven't seen her in a lot of things recently, but do you notice as well as like they're doing all this stuff for the children? There are no children.
No, there are no children. And I guess I don't know if that kind of plays into the fact that, you know, she gets pregnant at the end of episode 2, miraculously.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of this stuff kind of ties into about 30 to 40 years of comic history.
Bad comics history, we should say. An awful lot of it's just incredibly bad. bad in a way that it's like, it's regressive, it's sexist.
Problematic.
It's kind of problematic.
So I think that's why I think they might take inspiration from a lot of this stuff, but not actually go down that route, because
that would be suicide if they went down that route.
Well, not only that, but I think it's tiring to see the Wanda as a crazy person story narrative, right?
Yeah.
It's just, it's boring. And I think they're smarter than that. And given that...
Boring is one, but it's also too easy.
It is too easy. But I think what they're doing is they're taking imagery and visual cues from the comic books. And I think that's something that they did very, very well back then, even in the 1980s. There's some fantastic panels that people like Steve Englehart and Brian Michael Bendis did in the House of M storylines and all of that, which are really, really cool. But I think we're going to get something different. I think if you're really interested, you could go and track down these comics. But for the most part, just like how the MCU is structured, where they take visual cues and story ideas, they kind of craft their own thing over these last 12 years, right?
My I think so. I saw someone online, I mentioned it to you guys off mic, about someone saying that there's a Wanda bubble. That like her powers are either out of control or in someone else's control and are... This is a way of keeping her under control whilst they work their wicked way on her, or they get her to a certain point where she can do, she will be of the mindset to work for them. I mean, it could even call back to the Marvel comics, the evil Nazi Captain America stuff, where the Reds, I was looking up with the inclusion of Sword, I thought it was going to be the space sword, but it might not be. Was it Sword? I read your article. Was it Sword in Captain Marvel at the end?
No, Captain Marvel. Spider-Man Far From Home.
Oh, was it Sword? Did they have a logo or anything at that point? No?
Oh, no, they didn't have a logo.
He was just in space with some Kree, right?
But he was in space on a massive space station, so that's why I thought it was the Sword space station.
Yeah, but they have a funky, like, nice logo. But I think there's been that article as well that said it's sentient weapon as opposed to sentient world.
That's right.
And if I think that's a good... I mean, the Loki show is the temporal correctional group or something, right?
Yes.
Temporal. It's a very... I saw someone else mention it in an article, and I'd never even heard of them. So there is an actual comics group that are like, they're time cops.
Yeah.
This seems like they might be the kind of... social services for people who have like superpowers. Like, I wonder if they're wondering, because she is a sentient weapon. And what happens if a sentient weapon goes crazy? I had thought maybe it was a cosmic cube or something like that, because this is going back to, I'm rambling now, but the Captain America thing was the Red Skull convinced a sentient cosmic cube to repair Captain America, old Captain America, make him young again. But in doing so, they decided to tweak his history so he was part of Hydra, and that led to the Hail Hydra Captain America panel that blew up the internet or whatever like that. I had thought there was something like that going on here. But considering that it will eventually end in a multiverse of madness, they could go the Wanda being crazy route, but deal with it in a modern, proper... You know, not tasteful is the wrong word when you're dealing with mental illness, but deal with it in a realistic way that like, she was at the funeral at the end of Endgame... She struggled after that.
Yeah.
Maybe there's some incising incident and like they'll deal with it that way.
Yeah.
And she'll need at the end of the series, she'll need a doctor, and luckily that'll be Doctor Strange. But by that point, her problem's gotten so bad, it's a multiverse of issues or something.
And I think that's something that can be said for being more than just conjecture, right? Because it has, Kevin Feige has confirmed that essentially WandaVision leads directly into the new Doctor Strange coming up soon.
Because this is broadcast television. Doctor Strange will be cable.
Yeah.
There'll be more channels. That's the multiverse of madness.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
There'll just be like large sections of the movie set on like an ESPN set.
Yeah, it'd be great. I'd love to see that. If they do that, which they won't, because I think that's maybe a step too far. Just in between scenes, just change the channel. That'd be fucking awesome, right? Yeah.
Have Hulk Hogan go with the gremlins, arguing with them to put the film back in the can.
Because now Marvel Studios has control over this product as well. So it's not ABC doing it like Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and it's not Netflix doing it with Daredevil and Iron Fist and all that stuff. I'm assuming that all of their MCU actors have it contractually written down that they all have to take part in some way or other, right? Because
I don't
if they
think so.
Want to, well, because Kevin Feige said that with Disney Plus, I think it was one of the Comic-Con panels, he said now there is going to be a seamless integration between TV and the movies.
Yeah.
Because they tried to do that a little bit in the early seasons of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. where Sam Jackson cameoed in one episode. And I think someone from Thor cameoed in another episode.
Sif. Yeah.
Sif, Lady Sif. And then after season two, they were like, fuck this, let's just do our own thing, right?
Yeah.
Well, I think they talked about it as well with like the Captain America thing. I think they've talked about that in the production wise with because it was Marvel TV, right?
Yeah.
That's now defunct. And how the production just it wasn't possible. Whereas now they're doing all under one roof. They've made an awful lot of these actors incredibly rich. And so if they say, hey, you know, we can the COVID restrictions doesn't apply to Disney employees. We can fly you on the Mickey. We actually have a helicarrier. That was just real. This is Disney. We actually can just go. We can pick you up at your house. We're hovering overhead right now.
There
we
is a Disney bubble. Right?
Yeah, we can bring you to Miami and we can just shoot some scenes there and then we can have you home in time for tea time. You think Benedict Cumberbatch is going to say, nah, I got to sit in my house scratching my arse.
Yeah, I got to sit in my house and not do Sherlock.
You joke about the Disney bubble, but that's what they did with the NBA. They actually went to Disneyland in Florida and set up a bubble for that. So
they're also issuing vaccines in one of the Disneylands as well, right?
Yeah. Disney so World? You know
the convention center side of it. It's not like you go here's your vaccine now go on magic go on the runaway train
before you get on the flume.
Yeah.
Like it seems like they're breaking down that barrier between movie and TV. So with regards to Marvel Studios and whatever we see on Disney Plus. There isn't that, this is Marvel Television. This is working on a much lesser budget. It feels like everyone in their writers team or think tank or whatever brain trust now seems to be working across the medium.
Across the board.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that'll be quite exciting.
There was one thing. Did you notice the radio in episode 2 had like dials on the bottom, but there were missing numbers?
Oh, no, I didn't notice that.
I didn't notice that.
So there was the radio dial, right, where it said, Wanda, who's doing it to you? Also, there was a song playing at first that I couldn't make out, but then it kind of broke into Help Me, Wanda. Help Me, Wanda.
Yes.
Not Rhonda. Wanda.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was no 11. It started, it was the numbers from 5 till 5 till 16, but there was no 11, 13, or 15.
Huh.
Which is odd.
Yes.
Like, that's very odd. For I don't know, do radios not have, I mean, those aren't radio numbers anyway. They're usually like megahertz or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't know, old radios. So that was something that kind of stuck out to me. The inclusion of Strucker as a kind of an aside is weird as well. Like they have to be going somewhere with those illusions, right?
I think so, yeah. My read on both of those were either those were the sources of both the origins, Stark Industries and Strucker, and also the sources of Wanda's trauma, Stark Industry bomb and Strucker experimenting on her and Pietro. So I don't know if they were aside to the origins of these characters or whether Hydra is back.
Did you notice the same actors are in both ads?
Yes.
So it's like some part of like their life. I don't know. They're like three houses down in the Wanda bubble where their lives are just revolving around ads.
Yeah.
They're just doing ads all the time while Wanda's doing like proper plots.
There's a bunch of actors who were cast who haven't shown up yet. So Randall Park, I think, well, we heard his voice in episode 2.
So it's confirmed it was him, is it?
Oh, I just kind of replayed it many times and figured it sounded like him. I replayed this thing so many times, that song, like for a whole day, it was just like, WandaVision, was stuck in my head. But Randall Park, who played Jimmy Woo in the Ant-Man movies, as the FBI agent. Kat Dennings was announced to be in it, but she was in the Thor movies.
Apparently, I mean, I've been seeing it online a couple of times. People are saying that at the end of the episode one, when it pulls up from the TV show credits,
that
it's
hand.
Her hand.
Okay.
So maybe. Some people are saying it's her hand, but don't know. It's a bit of a reach.
And then Teyonah Parris, who plays Monica Rambeau, because when she was cast, it was announced that she was playing Monica Rambeau, like a grown-up Monica Rambeau.
And not Geraldine. I started focusing on the production design to a ridiculous extent. Like, on the first episode, there's all this weird shit on the wall because it's the 50s. Like, it changes between episodes.
Yeah.
It's just, like, weird art. And I was like, does it spell something? If I tilt my head. And she's wearing Geraldine's wearing a brooch that looks like a vortex.
Yeah.
And I was like, no,
somebody was
she
saying
didn't, she never became Vortex, right? She was Photon.
No, Monica Rambeau was the first Captain Marvel. Or the first female Captain Marvel, right?
But then she also became Photon later on. She's Photon based powers. She was in Next Wave.
Oh, was she? I missed that.
That was Monica Rambeau at Next Wave. She was, I think her powers became more light-based than Kree, whatever the fuck,
right.
At some point. But if this is wacky enough, like, the people who made this could totally do a Next Wave series.
Yes.
Next Wave and the Agents of Hate. Have you read that here?
No, I haven't.
Like, it is, it's a Rick and Morty style Marvel comedy.
Oof.
On a way.
Okay, I'm going to look that
you
up.
You know, where like they do, there is Agents of Hate, which is like a S.H.I.E.L.D. spinoff, but like it's just run by someone who's incredibly insecure and like weird and has weird sexual fetishes, but he has a helicopter going around after these other people who they're trying to fight back, and they fight Fing Fang Foom at one point because Fing Fang Foom is a thing in the Marvel Universe. They never bring up that often, and he is literally a giant lizard wearing purple pants, and I think he puts Robot Man in his pants.
Nice.
So I just looked it up, and of course it was created by Warren Ellis. Yes.
Of course it was. Because he's crazy.
Sounds about right now. Now it all
sounds... If you haven't read it, it is like... Warren Ellis has his problems these days, but it is incredibly funny. Kind of, you know, it's a little bit... not adult cartoonish, but you know what I mean? It has that Rick and Morty vibe to it, but like a superhero thing. And this is a decade before... Rick and Morty.
Yes,
but
2006.
If this is a path that's just building up to like building Monica Rambeau up enough so that she can have her own adventure, and then that series can end, and then at that point they can spin her off into just doing Next Wave, that'd be great.
All right. We want to hear your theories as well about WandaVision. Just drop us a line on any one of our social medias or email us at podcast@goggler.my. Don't forget to like this podcast and give us a nice comment, a thumbs up. 5 stars wherever you find your podcast. That really helps us out.
Let us know if you think AIM, Advanced Idea Mechanics, are going to be involved, and what you really think of Horny Vision, because he's extremely horny in this show.
He is. WandaVision, I think episode 3 will drop on Friday, and then 6 weeks after that, all the way up to episode 9. There was an interesting interview with Paul Bettany where he was talking about how I mean, this is what made me excited for the show, because he said he got to do something every week that eventually culminated in an MCU film. And so I was like, wow, that's an incredible scope for a TV series, right? So let's see how this whole thing plays out, and let's hope they land it at the end.
Yeah.
Also, check out One Night in Miami. That's streaming on Amazon Prime Video, and let us know what you think about that. You've been listening to another exciting episode of the Goggler Podcast.